You are listening to a programme from BBC Radio 4.
Order, order.
Good evening. This is Susan Hume at Westminster, where David Cameron says he'll decide by the end of the year whether to give the go-ahead on a third runway at Heathrow. But the MP for Heathrow says whole communities are at risk.
Today, the air pollution levels were double the legal limits in the EU. Noise will extend now to 1.5 million people if this decision goes ahead.
Also tonight, English votes on English issues. The SNP don't like the sound of it.
Will the Prime Minister confirm that he plans to exclude Scottish MPs from parts of the democratic process at Westminster?
Labour attack the Work and Pension Secretary's new definition of child poverty.
What he's read out today is the obituary notice for compassionate conservatism.
And has the much-delayed Chilcot report on the Iraq war been a waste of time?
No lessons have been learned. A lot of years have gone by and further mistakes have been made.
But first, the Prime Minister has told MPs he'll decide before the end of the year on how to respond to a commission on airport expansion in the southeast of England. The Airports Commission, led by Sir Howard Davis, has recommended that a third runway should be built at Heathrow, although it says expansion at Gatwick is feasible too. The Heathrow option is hugely controversial. Although the Chancellor is believed to be in favour, it's opposed by a number of prominent Conservative MPs, including Zach Goldsmith and the Mayor of London and Uxbridge MP Boris Johnson, who said he'd be prepared to lie down in front of the bulldozers to stop it. David Cameron himself said 6 years ago that no ifs, no buts, Heathrow expansion wouldn't happen. At question time, Labour's acting leader Harriet Harman wondered where he stood now.
Now that the Commission has recommended a third runway at Heathrow, does he agree with us that subject to key environmental tests being met, there should be no further delay and they should go ahead? Is he going to take that forward now?
David Cameron thanked Sir Howard Davis for the report, but his response was cautious.
It is important now that there's a very detailed report that we study it, and I'm very clear about the legal position that if we say anything now before studying the report, actually you could endanger whatever decision is made. But the guarantee I can give to the Honourable Lady is that a decision will be made by the end of the year.
But Harriet Harman baited him about the difference of opinion among Conservatives.
He gives the impression there's going to be a proper process, but there's something very different coming out of Number 10, because their briefing, it's not going to happen. It looks like the Prime Minister has been overruled by the member for Uxbridge, and he should tell him he's not the leader of the Tory party yet. He should tell him that. So can I ask the Prime Minister, will he stand up for Britain's interests or will he just be bullied by Boris?
Boris Johnson wasn't in the Commons, but the Conservative MP for Richmond, Zach Goldsmith, was. He hopes to be the party's candidate for mayor, and he said he'll trigger a by-election if the third runway goes ahead. He didn't think the report was impartial.
The Airports Commission began life 3 years or so ago with a conclusion and then spent £20 million backing up that conclusion. The Prime Minister is going to have to make a decision on the back of these recommendations shortly, but what assurances can he give the million or so Londoners who stand to be affected by Heathrow expansion that he will engage with the real arguments in the way that Sir Howard Davis has not?
David Cameron promised him the report would be properly studied because he didn't want to make any precipitate decision that could be open to judicial review. Well, we'll have more from Prime Minister's question time a little later, but the session was followed immediately by a statement from the Transport Secretary, Patrick McLoughlin, on the Airport Commission findings. Simon Jones was watching.
Patrick McLoughlin told MPs that the report of the Davis Commission was clear, reasoned and based on evidence. It needed respect and consideration. He outlined the next steps the government would take.
First, we must study the substantial and innovative evidence based on the Commission has produced. Second, we will need to decide on the best way for achieving planning consents quickly and fairly if expansion is to go ahead. Thirdly, we will come back to Parliament in the autumn to provide a clear direction on the government's plans.
The Transport Secretary said this was a vital moment and the government must act. His shadow, Michael Duggar, hoped that would be the case.
The public and businesses across the UK have been clear that they do not want any further dither or delay. Can he reassure the House that no matter how tempted the government might be, he will not kick this into the long grass? The short-term interests of the Conservative Party must not take priority over what is in the best long-term interests of the country.
Patrick McLaughlin pointed out to Mr Duggar that there were a number of Labour MPs opposed to any airport expansion. Among them is John McDonnell, who has Heathrow in his constituency. He reminded Mr McLaughlin of the Prime Minister's no-ifs-no-buts pledge that there would be no third runway.
Today, the air pollution levels were double the legal limits in the EU. Noise will extend now to 1.5 million people if this decision goes ahead. So does the Secretary of State think the onus is upon the Prime Minister now to come to my constituency, to meet my constituency, to meet my constituents whose homes and whole community is now at risk?
Tanya Mathias is the new Conservative MP for Twickenham in southwest London.
There is already too much noise pollution, and we're already, as my honourable friend said, the air quality pollution this morning is twice what it should be. Will he realise there is no alleviation possible for Twickenham residents?
The former Chancellor, the Conservative, Ken Clark, stressed the importance of a competitive economy.
In the end, decisions on major infrastructure projects, fracking, whatever it may be, should be taken on a clear judgment of the national interest of the country as a whole.
The South London MP and Liberal Democrat, Tom Brake, said many of his constituents were enjoying their gardens on what was the hottest day of the year so far.
Can the Secretary of State confirm, no ifs, no buts, that they'll be able to continue to enjoy that amenity in years to come, and their lives will not be blighted by increased noise and reduced air quality as a result of any decisions that he will make later on this year?
Patrick McLaughlin said the problems of noise and air pollution would have to be addressed. The Green MP, Caroline Lucas, had a suggestion.
It's a small number of very wealthy people flying very regularly, not most families taking an annual holiday, that is actually driving demand. So will he agree to look seriously at a new proposal for a frequent flyer levy as a way of tackling the health and environmental impacts of growing aviation?
Labour's Sadiq Khan is seeking to become his party's candidate for Mayor of London.
We all want jobs and growth, so will he seriously look at plans to expand Gatwick to have an additional capacity there and have high-speed link between Heathrow and Gatwick so we can have jobs and growth without causing the misery Runway 3 would cause?
But the Conservative and West Sussex MP Nick Herbert profoundly disagreed.
Gatwick would deliver fewer benefits, half the economic benefit than Heathrow, had poorer transport links, especially to the north, and crucially would not deliver the hub solution that this country needs.
For the SNP, Drew Hendry stressed the report's recommendation that there should be more flights to Scotland.
We hope that the decisions taken will finally provide a fairer deal for Scotland's people, and one that will provide a significant boost to our economy.
An appeal echoed by MPs from Northern Ireland. Patrick McLaughlin, though, maintained throughout his hour at the dispatch box that he would not prejudge any decisions that may be taken later in the year.
Simon Jones reporting. Well, back at Prime Minister's Questions, David Cameron announced that a ministerial committee was being set up to coordinate help and support for those affected by last Friday's attack by a gunman on tourists in Tunisia, which left 38 people dead, most of them British. As the 10th anniversary of the 7/7 London bombings draws near, Harriet Harman talked about the lessons learned from that.
The bereaved and those who've experienced life-changing injuries and trauma will need long-term practical and emotional support. The experience after 7/7 was that to really help those affected families, there needs to be coordination across departments and agencies. So will he establish a dedicated task force reporting to a minister to support those who've suffered in this terrible attack?
The Prime Minister said 8 bodies were already being brought back to the UK by the RAF.
Every family of a victim now has a dedicated Foreign Office liaison officer, but I can confirm what she asked, and I've asked the Cabinet Secretary for advice on creating a ministerial committee to ensure that work is properly coordinated right across government to provide all the support that the victims of this appalling attack deserve, and also to make sure that as a nation we mark and commemorate this event appropriately.
The Scottish Nationalist leader at Westminster, Angus Robertson, sent his party's condolences too to the people caught up in the tragedy in Tunisia. But his MPs launched coordinated complaints during question time about the plan to exclude Scottish, Welsh and Northern Irish MPs from some stages of legislation which concerns only England, for example on health, which is devolved to the National Assemblies and Parliaments. But the Nationalists don't believe the matter is so clear-cut. The SNP's Angela Crawley made the first move.
The Prime Minister's plans for English votes for English laws will reduce my rights and the rights of other Scottish MPs in the House of Commons. But the real issue is my ability to protect the interests of my constituents of Lanark and Hamilton East.
She wanted a guarantee that no bills which had any impact, even indirectly, on Scotland's budget would be designated as England only. David Cameron said he'd publish the proposal shortly, but...
We are not creating a system of two tiers for MPs. All MPs will still vote on all bills, but what we're saying is that laws which only apply in England should only pass if they're supported by a majority of English MPs.
But a few minutes later, Angus Robertson pressed the point.
Because of the way the United Kingdom is structured, decisions on health, on education, and much English legislation has an impact on the Scottish budget. Will the Prime Minister confirm that he plans to exclude Scottish MPs from parts of the democratic process at Westminster that will have an impact on Scotland?
David Cameron didn't think it was Scottish MPs who faced discrimination.
English MPs are entirely excluded from any discussion of Scottish health or Scottish housing or Scottish education. What we are proposing is actually a very measured and sensible step.
He said only English MPs would vote when a bill was going through its detailed scrutiny stage, but all MPs could vote at the later stages. Now, MPs on the government side are usually supportive during Prime Minister's questions, or at most only mildly critical. But one Conservative, Jack Lopresti, who served with the reserves in Afghanistan, made an outspoken call for the government to stick to its commitment to spend at least 2% of national income on defence.
Does the Prime Minister feel comfortable that a Conservative government has implemented a spending target on foreign aid, but will not commit to a target of a minimum of 2% of GDP on defence? And does he realise that this is damaging the relationship with our key strategic ally, the United States, and risking our credibility with our NATO allies?
David Cameron said the UK had met the target every year, and that was in a European Union in which some countries didn't invest even 1% of income on defence. You're listening to Today in Parliament on Radio 4. Still to come, a moving maiden speech by a new MP who suffered twice from cancer.
I thank the nurse who in 1995 held my hand all night while we discussed the future of my 1 and 2 year old children.
But first, the Work and Pensions Secretary Ian Duncan-Smith has announced a new way of measuring child poverty. The new system, he said, would focus on the root causes of poverty and make a meaningful change to children's life chances. Labour said the change represented the death of any idea that the Conservatives were a compassionate party. Rachel Byrne reports.
Ian Duncan-Smith is to scrap the measure of child poverty and targets introduced by Labour in 2010. A child is currently defined as being in poverty when living in a household with an income below 60% of the UK's average. The Work and Pensions Secretary said this had unintended consequences.
A growing economy ironically drives increases in the measures of child poverty, whilst if the economy crashes, as happened under the last government, child poverty then apparently falls. Even today, if we were to increase elements of the state pension, we run the risk of increasing the median income and thus increasing the number of households who then fall into poverty.
Mr. Duncan-Smith said new legislation would introduce a statutory duty to report on worklessness and levels of educational attainment, key areas, he believed, in improving social mobility. A range of other indicators would be developed to measure what he said were the root causes of poverty.
We know that in households with unstable relationships, where debt and addiction destabilise families, where parents lack employment skills, where children just aren't ready to start school, these children don't have the same chances in life as others. It's self-evident. They cannot break out of that cycle of disadvantage.
Mr. Duncan Smith said the government would focus on making a meaningful change to children's lives by extending opportunity for all. But the Shadow Work and Pensions Minister, Stephen Timms, saw it quite differently.
What he's read out today is the obituary notice for compassionate conservatism. It's the death knell for any idea that his party might one day be a party for working people.
Mr. Timms said the Work and Pensions Secretary hoped nobody would notice this significant announcement because it coincided with the Transport Secretary's statement on airport expansion. It also came on the day of what Mr. Timms said was a worrying report.
The Children's Commissioners for England, Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland have today joined together to warn that the government's policies will push more young people into poverty. What happened, Mr. Speaker, to the long-term plan? Why have children been left out?
But Labour's Frank Field, a former welfare reform minister and now chair of the Commons Work and Pensions Committee, welcomed what Ian Duncan Smith had to say, although he reckoned there was more to do.
Hasn't this government and the previous Labour government been successful, largely in its welfare-to-work scheme of moving people from benefit to work? Isn't welfare to work Mark II now agenda? How do we move so many of them who are trapped in low pay up their pay scale so that they earn decent wages?
Other Labour and SNP MPs raised the prospect of further welfare cuts, particularly to tax credits. Labour's Wes Streeting spoke of children who are in poverty despite their parents working.
How can it possibly be fair in next week's budget or at some point in the future to cut the tax credits for those particular families, because all he said today about measures and everything else will not help those parents and those households pay the bills when he cuts their tax credits overnight?
Ian Duncan Smith replied with an attack on Labour ideology.
They're still wedded to this idea that it is only through consistent and total government spending can anybody move beyond their status of being in poverty. That is the difference, I believe, between these two sides. We believe that by helping, encouraging and getting people back to work, reducing the burden of tax on them, we get people likely to move beyond poverty.
Labour, he said, thought only government action succeeded.
Rachel Byrne there. Now, for every pound a working man is worth, why is every working woman worth only 73 pence? A question posed by the Shadow Equalities Minister, Gloria De Piero, as she led an Opposition Day debate on the pay gap between the sexes.
Today, girls are outperforming boys at school and university. But even at ages 18 to 21, women are paid less on average than young men of their age. When women hit their 20s, already 5p behind their male colleagues. And this gap continues to widen throughout women's working lives, peaking when women reach their 50s, where they can expect to earn just 73p for every male pound.
A Labour motion said the Equalities Commission and Low Pay Commission should jointly make an annual equal pay check on employers in all parts of the economy and then come up with recommendations on how the gender pay gap could be closed. Ms. De Piero talked about the scope of the annual check.
Why today is most low paid work done by women? Women do 59% of all minimum wage jobs. A quarter of working women earning less than the living wage compared to a sixth of men. Why just 9.6% of exec directors on FTSE boards women? By monitoring and assessing the evidence, the annual equal pay check will help us determine whether the continued existence of the pay gap is driven mainly by a lack of women in top jobs.
In reply, the Minister for Women, Nicky Morgan, said one reason for the pay gap was the fact that women were less likely to go into higher paid industries. Her experience from her other job as Education Secretary told her what teenage girls studied in their later school years.
The evidence shows that their subject choices have a direct impact on their future careers and earnings. And that imbalance can feed directly through to our labour market.
She said the government's record was strong.
As a result of the actions this government has taken, and as a result of having a strong economy, women are playing a greater role than ever before in the labour market. There are more women in work than ever before, and there are also more women-led businesses than ever before.
Nicky Morgan there. Well, over in the Lords, ministers were roundly criticised over their childcare bill. The bill's designed to implement the Conservative election pledge to provide 30 hours of free childcare per week in England. However, peers complain that the bill is too vague, leaving much of the detail to be decided by ministers once the bill has become law. The shadow leader of the Lords, Labour's Lady Smith, said an influential Lords committee had criticised the bill.
This isn't at all a party political matter. Far from it. The committee is cross-party and we on this benches support the aims of the bill. But for the House to do its job, it must have more than the bones of a policy to scrutinise.
The Lib Dems deputy leader, Lord Wallace of Tankerness, thought he knew why the bill was so sketchy.
This does have the hallmark of a party policy announcement during a general election, which they're now desperately trying to figure out what it actually means and how to put it together.
But a Conservative, Lady Eaton, irritated opposition peers by suggesting they were getting hung up on procedure.
I don't think the electorate are particularly interested in the finer points of how we reach conclusions.
The Minister, Lord Nash, told peers that the government would not press on to the further stages of the childcare bill till October, giving time for the government to bring forward more detail. But he felt the basics were quite clear.
It places a duty on the Secretary of State to make available 30 hours of free childcare for working parents. That is a pledge that was in the Conservative Party manifesto at the general election and is similar to what was in the Labour Party's manifesto. And I make no apology for the fact that we are getting on with delivering that pledge.
Lord Nash there. There's been a call to scrap the controversial inquiry into the Iraq war by Sir John Chilcot. In the Lords, several peers vented their frustration at the long delay in the publication of the inquiry's findings. Peter Mulligan reports.
The Chilcot inquiry was set up in 2009 and was meant to report in 2011. Still, it drags on, even though the Prime Minister himself has said he's losing patience. Delays are blamed on what's called the Maxwellisation process, where in advance of publication, witnesses are given the chance to respond to criticism. But peers have clearly had enough. The former Attorney General, Labour's Lord Morris, fired the opening salvo.
Since Parliament is the ultimate guardian of the independence of any inquiry, and since this one seems incapable of reporting, should not the Prime Minister pull the plug, discharge the committee, and on the basis of the evidence already gathered, come to Parliament for its advice as to a way forward?
The Cabinet Office Minister, Lord Bridges, said he shared the frustration, but he couldn't go along with Lord Morris's demand.
The general gist was that we should scrap the inquiry. I cannot agree with the noble lord on this. The inquiry, first of all, is independent of government. Fine, and most importantly of all, it has taken a long time to get this far, and that we agree, but it needs to be able to complete its work as quickly as possible so we can learn the lessons, and removing them from office or stopping this now is not in the best interests of this work.
The veteran Liberal Democrat, Lady Williams, wasn't impressed.
The increasing impression being given is that there are crucial facts that people do not want to come out into the public transparency where they can be discussed and debated.
The Minister, Lord Bridges, had with him a letter written by the Prime Minister
in which he asked the Cabinet Secretary to meet Sir John as soon as possible to discuss progress for the completion of the report and ways in which the civil service can assist the inquiry in the urgent completion of its work.
The former Defence Secretary, the Conservative Lord King, said there was total impatience on all sides of the House. Any future inquiry would have to have a time limit.
This is meant to provide opportunity for lessons to be learnt from what happened over Iraq. No lessons have been learnt. A lot of years have gone by and further mistakes have been made.
This time, Lord Bridges quoted Sir John Chilcot himself.
I would just draw my noble friend's attention to what Sir John Chilcot told the Foreign Affairs Select Committee in the other place, that he had seen no evidence that anyone was trying to delay the publication of the report by holding out from responding or entering into argument about the maxwellisation process.
But the process was irking a former leader of the Lords, Labour's Lord Richard. He said an inquiry chairman had a mandatory duty to get the response of witnesses in advance of publication, yet a committee of peers had recommended a different approach.
The maxwellisation process should cease to be mandatory and should be left to the discretion of the chairman, The government so far have refused to take that on board.
That, the minister said, would have to wait until the inquiry concluded. And he underlined it was independent and needed to remain so.
Peter Mulligan reporting. The day saw a few more maiden speeches in the Commons. In a moving speech, Jo Churchill, the new Conservative MP for Bury St Edmunds, described herself as a survivor.
A double cancer survivor, I thank the nurse who in 1995 held my hand all night while we discussed the future of my 1 and 2 year old children. Her politics, irrelevant, but her care was essential. In 2010, a different cancer, but an amazing doctor who cared for me. And by then, our 4 teenage daughters' reaction to the news.
The SNP's Ronnie Cowan represents Inverclyde, an area where shipbuilding was once the dominant industry. He spoke about his childhood.
When I was a child, my late father owned a pub. One of my jobs was to stand at the end of the bar and shout, "Time, gentlemen, please." I never knew that in a few short years it would be the shipyards of the Lower Clyde we were shouting time on and not the pubs. Inverclyde has never fully recovered.
The London Labour MP Neil Coyle, who beat the veteran Lib Dem Simon Hughes at the election, indicated he had a lot to live up to in political terms.
I am the third Member of Parliament to make a maiden speech for Bermondsey since the Second World War. My predecessor Simon Hughes served for 32 years. His predecessor, the Labour MP Bob Mellish, served for 36 years. It's already been pointed out to me how hard I'll have to work in order to sustain anywhere like that kind of average.
The Scottish Nationalist MP for Stirling, Stephen Patterson, highlighted his constituency's history. He said it was a former administrative capital of Scotland and the scene of many important battles.
Most famously, of course, the Battle of Bannockburn.
Yeah.
Where a force superior only in numbers were defeated by a skillful and determined force with superior tactics and better knowledge of the terrain.
Yeah.
Mr. Speaker, I know that many in this House will be keen on parliamentary history, so I should say that following that battle, Robert the Bruce convened the Parliament in my constituency in Cambus Kenneth Abbey. It was a fine example of a powerful and independent Scottish Parliament.
Yeah.
Stephen Patterson there. Finally, in just a few minutes' time, England's women's football team are due to kick off in their World Cup semi-final match against Japan. The England men's team haven't got this far in a World Cup for 25 years. At question time, David Cameron wished the team luck.
I'm sure the whole House will wish to join with me, indeed the whole House, in congratulating the England women's football team on reaching the semi-finals of the World Cup in Canada and wishing them well for their match against Japan this evening.
Harriet Harman is rooting for them too.
Can I join the Prime Minister in his congratulations to England's women's football team? With only a fraction of the resources the men get, they are showing the men how it's done.
And the closing headline from Parliament. The Prime Minister has said he'll decide by the end of the year on whether to accept a recommendation to build a third runway at Heathrow. And the government has announced a new way of measuring child poverty. I'm Susan Hume, the editor was Keith McDougall, and that was Today in Parliament.
You can download many more BBC Radio 4 programmes for free. Find these at bbc.co.uk/radio4.